welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon. This is Jeffrey Higgins, off screen. I'm excited today. We're broadcasting from Creatures, Crimes, and Creativity, the C3 conference in Columbia, Maryland. We're doing some shorts today on the conference. With me today is Reed Farrell Coleman. He's been called a hard-boiled poet by NPR's Maureen Corrigan and Noir Poet Laureate in the Huffington Post. Reed Farrell Coleman is a New York Times bestselling author of 31 novels, amazing, by the way, including the Nick Ryan series and 6 in the Robert B. Parker, Jesse Stone series, which I loved. Short story, I'll just keep adding my own comments into your bio in case you want to expand it later. Short stories, poetry, and essays, he's written it all. In addition to his acclaimed series characters, Mo Prager and Gus Murphy, he has written the standalone novel Gun Church and collaborated with decorated Irish crime writer Ken Bruin on the novel Tower. Reed is a 4-time Edgar Award nominee in 3 different categories, which I've never heard of before. Best novel, best paperback original, and best short story. He's a 4-time recipient of the Seamus Award for Best PI Novel of the Year. He's also won the Audie, McCavity, Barry, and Anthony Awards. With their kids moved away to far-off Brooklyn, Reed and his wife Roseanne and their cats live in the wilds of Suffolk County on Long Island. So, Reed, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So let me ask you, we're doing these shorts here. By the way, you've won and you've been nominated in 3 categories. Has anyone else ever done that you're aware of?
Who cares?
I mean, it's amazing. So you have this really, long and distinguished career here. What motivates you to come to these conferences at this point in your career?
Well, I was a keynote speaker here once and feel I owe it to Austin and the organizers to show my support occasionally. And Tom Straw, who is one of the 2 keynote speakers this year, is a really close friend of mine and feel, we feel sorry for Tom. So we feel we should support him because no one else loves him.
Well, so when you were coming up and first learning to write, did you attend conferences like these?
You know, it's funny, when I was first of all, I never took a fiction writing class in my life. I studied poetry. I never took a fiction writing class. It's actually an interesting story, if you have a minute, of how I became a crime novelist. When I was 15, I watched somebody die of a gunshot wound in my old neighborhood. That affected me deeply. And then I worked at the cargo area at Kennedy Airport for 5 years. So if you've ever seen Goodfellas, those are the people I work with. They were all named Vinny, by the way. And when I worked at the airport, I used to have to go one day a week into Manhattan for meetings. And there were a lot of hours to kill between the time I left work and had to go to the city. And so I went back to Brooklyn College and took a night class. And the only night class that kind of fit my schedule was a reading class on American detective fiction. And I had never read detective fiction. I was a real snob, a poet. The closest I'd come to detective fiction would be Kurt Vonnegut. To me, crime fiction were the cheesy books on my dad's nightstand with the covers of half-naked women holding guns. So that never interested me. And the first 3 books we read in this class were The Continental Op by Dashiell Hammett, The Maltese Falcon by Dashiell Hammett, and Farewell, My Lovely by Raymond Chandler. And this is the truth, and if my wife was here, she would swear to it. I came home the night we were done discussing Farewell, My Lovely, and I said, I want to quit my job at the airport. I think I can do this. And for the second time in her life, she said yes to me and has deeply regretted it both times.
So what is it about poets or literary writers that make them look down at genre fiction, like detective fiction?
I don't know, because to me, first of all, I'm on a panel later about what is crime fiction. And to me, all fiction is crime fiction. Here comes my stock answer. Moby Dick and the Count of Monte Cristo are revenge novels. How did Gatsby make his money? I mean, ultimately, all fiction asks 3 or 4 questions. Where did I come from? where am I going and what does it mean? So in its deepest, most basic reductive form, all fiction is kind of a mystery. It's all crime fiction. So that's my professorial academic answer.
If you don't have the mystery in it, what is it that would drive a reader to keep going?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because of course, all crime writers call literary fiction books without plots. a lot of navel gazing, and some of it's great, and some of it deserves its accolades. But what pays the bills at big publishing houses is nonfiction and crime fiction or genre fiction. So, you know, while it's great to admire beautiful writing, it doesn't pay the bills. What pays the bills is genre fiction and nonfiction.
Do you see overlap between, like, you know, the navel gazing and literary fiction, but gorgeous prose, but then also really well-written literary crime fiction or genre fiction? Because there clearly are some writers who just stand above.
Yeah, well, I'd like to think that I'm in that category. Yeah. Either that or people just feel sorry for me and keep publishing me. I don't think there's necessarily a divergence there. I think good writing is good writing. And beautiful writing is beautiful writing. And I don't see why there can't be beautiful writing in genre fiction. As a matter of fact, Michael Connelly, who people just, police procedural, whatever. If people could write like Michael Connelly, it's simple language, but beautiful, simple language. You don't have to use big, you know, what we used to call 50-cent words for beautiful writing. On the other hand, there's unfortunately passed away a few years ago, Philip Kerr, who writes the Bernie Gunther novels. I don't know if you're familiar. If you're not, you should read them. He's an amazingly gorgeous writer with complicated plots. And I'd like to think I fall in there, in between. And there's nothing wrong or contradictory about it, as long as you give people a reason to turn the page. And I don't think necessarily just beautiful writing gives people reason to turn the page. I like propelling people through it. And my first job is entertainment. And any writer who doesn't see that is missing the point.
How much of, like, because literary is a genre, but it's also a descriptive on the writing itself. How much is, like, word choice in prose or descriptive sections versus maybe going deeper, like you do in your books, in addressing more substantive parts of the human experience?
I think every word, of course the stock answer is every word that goes down on the page is important. And that's true. And I really do focus really heavily on the word usage. But my son, who's in does art, is writing a book. And what I said to him is, be conversational, right? It's not a different language. You speak in this language, write in this language. And actually, that's the best tip I could give anybody who's starting out, is write the way you speak. Well, not like me, but write the way you speak. I think people get nervous when they sit down at the computer and think, I have to produce, you know, magic. No, you know how to speak, so just write the way you speak.
So how much of, like, that authorial voice is the genuine voice of the person versus, like, their perception and the way they see the world?
You know, that's a great question, which authors always say when they have to think of what the answer is. I think, I know Janet Ivanovich a little bit, and what she'll say is voice, 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 that everything is voice. And I think that's the thing about good writing, is no matter what series I write, whether it's a series or a standalone, you will recognize my authorial voice. And that is like a brand. We were talking about brand off camera. And in some ways, your voice is your brand. So that no matter what I write, you will recognize my voice if you know my work. And that's what writers should also strive for. Find their own voice. And in some ways, sometimes that involves copying somebody. Like I started out, I sounded like Raymond Chandler, who would have hated me, by the way. But that is a way to start, is you want to find a voice, copy someone else's voice for a while. Or be conversational and you'll find your own voice.
How long did it take you to find your own voice?
Oh, I think I was born with this voice. I think poetry really helped me find my voice.
Interesting. So
that I came to fiction writing with a voice. Now, when I wrote fiction, I didn't have the confidence that I had that voice. So I did. I copied Chandler and I, you know, tried to do those ridiculous metaphors that he could get away with that, you know, most of us who try it go, oh my God, another pale imitation of Raymond Chandler. So, but that's a way to do it. And that's how I gained. And I was very lucky. My first long piece of fiction that I ever wrote was published as my first novel. Now that's a blessing and a curse because I can't bear to read it, but it got me started. And I often say to my wife and kids that I don't know if I didn't get published early on, if I would have stuck with it. I would have been a poet, a destitute poet.
I have so many questions about this. So like, how does the poetry itself, because it's so difficult and every word counts, right? There's so much there and you're looking at pacing and rhythm and all these other things that are part of fiction, but not the same. How did that directly influence voice? Because you'd mentioned that.
The best training for fiction writing is writing poetry because you have to be spare and everything has to count. I think a lot of times when you're writing fiction and you're not experienced, you don't know what counts and what doesn't count. Also, I have, although not my, a lot of my poetry was not rhyming, it was metrical and it was lyrical. Maureen Corrigan called me a hard-boiled poet for a reason, is because that lyricism and that rhythm is in my writing, whether I'm conscious of it or not, it's there. And so I'm very lucky to have started as a poet. And a lot of mystery writers started as poets, as a matter of fact. Raymond Chandler was a poet. Ken Bruin, whom recently passed away, started as a poet. A writer a lot of people don't know but should know, Peter Spiegelman, started as a poet. A lot of people, that's where their grounding is in writing, is poetry.
And I think a hard-boiled poet might be the best description I've ever heard.
It's great.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, I call, you know, some of my other writer friends, oh, it's the soft-boiled poet. It's the over-easy poet. I couldn't have made that up. That it was, it's something Maureen bestowed upon me that I will never, that will always be the first line of my bio, is called a hard-boiled poet.
Yeah, it's perfect. Yeah. So you mentioned like looking back at your first novel, and you know we all do that, right? Because you get better with every novel. But going even back before that, when you're into poetry, how much of this is the nature versus nurture thing? Like how much of being a storyteller is something you're born with?
I think talent is a necessary ingredient, but how much talent? I don't know. Hard work counts for a lot. Luck counts for a lot. Good looks and blue eyes count.
Of course.
He says laughing. I think talent is a necessary ingredient. But how much talent? I don't know. I don't know how talented I am. I know I work really hard at it, and I've had some success at it. I taught writing at Hofstra University for a while. And what I would do is I'd have my students come up and tell a joke. If you can tell a joke, you probably have some writing talent. I really mean that. Yeah. Because it's a narrative. A joke is just a short narrative. And, you know, my wife, I met her in a writing class in the New School at,
oh, really?
Yeah, in New York. That's another interesting story. But she's an occupational therapist. And she could write poetry. And by the way, I knew I had her snagged because 2 years we had lost touch after we met. I bumped into her on the street and could quote her poetry back to her.
Oh, there you go. You are the master.
She was finished. She was finished after that. She can't tell a joke worth a damn. She can't tell it. You know, she's very tangential. So, you know, can she write poetry? Yes. But she's the first person to tell you she would have a very hard time writing a book because she's too tangential.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that first book, if you hadn't had that contract, maybe because the business is so tough, you would have dropped out. And obviously, we would have lost a huge body of work. What is it, or how would you tell, like, new writers when they're fighting through? Because it's a tough business, right? Like,
oh.
What should keep them going to break through and get that moment of opportunity?
Drugs.
Do you have anything in particular you recommend?
Yeah, no.
As I sit here drinking my third coffee of the morning.
No, it's a tough business, and I think that's a good thing to know when you're going in that you're going to get hit and smacked in the face a lot. And if you're not the type of person who can deal with rejection or getting smacked down a lot, then maybe this, you're right for yourself. Not everybody is meant to be, a published author or publish yourself. But, if you're going to go into it, I've always said there's writing is art, publishing is a business. And there's always these, like, kind of moving targets of where they intersect. Can you tell I've done this for a while?
I can, yeah. But so since you mentioned it, like, how has the business in, like, the last couple of years changed?
I mean, my first novel was published in 1991. Last century! And, you know, then there were a lot of houses that weren't all under the five major houses. So you could submit without agents to some of them, which is I did. You could just buy the writer's guide and just submit like crazy. These days, you won't get an agent that way. You won't get a publisher that way. The business has become much harder because, you know, there are five major publishing houses, basically, and they have all the imprints, and they all have certain rules that you have to follow. The Wild West is gone. So it's a much tougher business. And I don't know. People say, how did you get started? Well, how I got started, you can't get started that way anymore. And I would say I'm very fortunate that there was a small publishing house on Long Island that paid me a bigger advance, actually, than a lot of these publishers now pay. And there's a term in Yiddish, bubkis, means nothing. That's what people get paid now. And it's a tough bit. Why anybody would want to do this other than if they're I call it an affliction. I have no choice. I'm afflicted with this, and it's chronic.
Have you ever tried to stop or taken a break or had a bad experience?
No, I've had tons of bad experiences. Trust me, I've had a lot of bad experiences, but it never stops me because I literally am afflicted with this. I used to tell my writing students, if you think you're getting into this to have people throw roses at your feet, go work for a florist because that's just not happening. And there's a lot of dark times during this. And almost everyone's writing careers almost is like this.
Yeah.
It's up and down. And I mean, I started at a small publishing house. I got picked up by Plume and Viking. I lost my contract there, even on a book that was Edgar nominated and won the Seamus Award. Okay. Then I was at a small publishing house. Then I was at Putnam. You know, that's just how it goes.
On the contract you lost, did you lose that before you won the awards, or did you lose it and then you won the awards?
I was nominated for the awards. If I had won the Edgar for the book, I might have kept the contract, but I did, and the awards I did win for that book, they just weren't enough. I mean, that's publishing. Then it was hurtful. Now it's just publishing. You know, a friend of mine just lost a contract for the first time. I mean, he'd been in the business 20 years or more, and he had a famous editor who had protected him because he loved his writing so much. Those days are over. The days of the powerful editor, so powerful that they're going to publish you because they love your work, those days are gone. So it was quite a startling revelation to him that, oh, now I'm on the street. And it's a hard thing to face the first time. You know, look at the scars. I mean, I've been there a few times. It's hard. This is a hard. I mean, you're putting yourself up for a lot of rejection. It's great when it's good. It's great when it's great, and it really sucks when it's bad.
With the turnover of editors, acquiring editors at these big publishing houses, I mean, I think the average is like less than 3 years now, right? They're just going through. How does that change your relationship with the publisher, and how do you deal through the process of not just creating a manuscript but looking at what's next for you?
Well, there's always the thing is, do you have a contract, or is your agent presenting the book on spec? That's always, you know, a different thing. And when I, right in the middle of my doing the Jesse Stone books for the Parker Estate, my editor, who had been Parker's editor for 20 years, they parted ways. And that was a difficult thing because the editor they assigned me had never even read a Parker book.
Wow.
So I went from someone who had institutional memory and, like the person who knew Jesus, and to someone who was a different, who was a different religion. It was very jarring. And you'd think, oh, good, you can get away with doing anything you want. But I actually, when Chris left Putnam, it was kind of scary for me because now I didn't have somebody to say to me, you don't go there. You know, that's not where Bob would have gone. So that, you know, I imagine it can be very jarring for people who face that. It was jarring for me. I had hair before.
So you mentioned a lot of this in the difficulty of the business, and writers are all types. There's a lot of very introverted people. There's people who, you spend a lot of time
introverted,
in isolation.
You mean like me?
Yeah, exactly like you. Yeah, shy, retiring flowers, wallflowers. So do you give any piece of advice when you're teaching or when you're working with young writers about how to handle this kind of rejection and to stay focused on
story?
What?
I think what I've learned over the years is you don't want – You say things like, look, it's a tough business, and you do metaphorical things like, if you want people to throw roses at your feet, right, go work for a florist. But you don't want to scare, because you don't want to scare somebody. If somebody really has the bug, you don't really want to push them away from it, even though who wants the competition if they're really good, which I'm joking about. Because one thing that is great about mystery writers is, as a community goes, we are the most accepting, optimistic, encouraging group, I think, of writers that there are. Because it's not a zero-sum game. Your success doesn't mean less success for me, you bastard. No, it's really not. And I don't want to be, you never want to be too discouraging, I think, in the beginning. So, you know, that's my attitude is, You warn people that it's a tough business, and if you don't deal with rejection well, maybe this isn't for you.
Do you find that the students that you've had and the writers you've had, that there's something internally within them that no matter what you say to discourage them, they're not going to stop?
Well,
writing.
Those are the people who make it.
Yeah.
The people who won't stop. Now, a lot of them won't make it, and a lot of them will be very disappointed and very hurt, but one or two of them will make it. Because it kind of takes that kind of pig-headed, like me. I generally, I'm not a stubborn person, but about this, I'm very pig-headed. I, you know, someone said, I have 5 books in the pipeline now, right? So someone said, did you, you know, you're going to stop writing? And what else? No, I'm not going to stop writing. Does it matter if any of them don't get published? And it's what I do. It would be stupid for me to say, oh, now I'm going to just play pickleball all day, or, you know, I can't help it. I would, as my wife says, you stop becoming you when you don't write for 2 weeks. Once you don't write for 2 weeks, I don't recognize you because I don't recognize me.
How does that manifest itself? Like, and by the way, I love that line from your wife because it's really true, right? If you're not writing, that's sort of your touchstone in so many ways.
Right.
But like, what happens when you're pulled away from external forces?
I get cranky. I become too critical of other people. I become unhappy and depressed, even more so than I am naturally. I think if this is what you do, this is my routine every, right? Like me, well, we'll go away to, let's say, to Spain. In October, we went to Spain for 9 days. And I needed to get back home. Mostly to start writing again, because I can't, when I'm on vacation, like that kind of vacation, it's not fair to my wife for me to say, okay, I'm going to take 3 hours now. We're not going to the, you know, the Prado, because right. I have to, yeah, so I don't, but I need to get back to my routine. Even when we went to BoucherCon, right? I brought my computer, see, at BoucherCon, since my wife goes to panels and stuff, I brought my computer with me because I was finishing a book. Nice. And when I'm at the end of a book, it's like a snowball rolling downhill. Yeah. I can't stop for 4 days. We're done. No, no, no. The computer's coming with me.
Have you ever been pulled away from a story like that and then had difficulty getting back into it or keeping all those threads that were forming in your mind?
No, what's funny is that's one thing that is not difficult for me is I'm not an outliner. So I've always had to be good at keeping the threads and sometimes stopping a little bit may give you some perspective that I didn't have before. But generally, I just push ahead.
You mentioned like 3 hours to write. Do you need a block like that to get into it?
Yeah, I have a, you know, pretty set routine. I get up in the morning, I feed the cats. I torture the cat. No, no, no. We have 4 cats, so there's a lot of feeding that goes on. I have a cup of coffee. I read the newspaper. I still physically read the newspaper. I do the puzzles. Then I go down to my office. I do 15 minutes of Facebook answering emails, and then I write. You know, but I'm not a word count guy. Like, I have friends who say, if I don't write 1,500 words, it's not a successful day. For me, sometimes I'll write 500 words and sometimes I'll write 2,000 words. So, you know, if you write a page a day, in a year you have a book. And I generally write books in less than a year. So,
do you think it's important to write every day
to
keep it moving in your subconscious?
For me, you know, I'll never say my way is the right way. But of course it is. My way is the right way or the only way, which I think when anybody tells you that, don't pay attention to them. Like that's a warning sign that that person is not somebody you should listen to. Because, you know Jeffrey Deaver, right?
Yeah.
And Jeff writes these crazy outlines.
90-page outlines.
90-page outlines, right? And Stephen King will say, outlining is the last resort of a mediocre writer. Now, obviously, he doesn't mean that about Jeff Deaver.
Right.
But however it works for you, it works for you. And anybody who says, you must do it this way, is somebody I won't listen to. And I don't think writers should listen to somebody who says, you must do it this way. Because, I mean, this is art. There's no one way to do art. Yes, I think it's art, Mr. Wright.
Of course it's art. So I have one question that I ask all our writers, and that is, where do you think story comes from? You know, this is being created out of thin air. Where is that? Are you channeling the story? Is it your experience? Where does it come from?
I get it from a post office box in Schenectady.
Nice.
For me, it's you know, I don't trust writers who are 20 years old. And because what do they know? What have they experienced? Now, some have, you know, some African-American kid who's lived on the street and, you know, and you know, has parents who's lost a job, or some kid, some, you know, kid from South America who's hiked up here, you know, through several countries, and now is facing expulsion. That 20-year-old, that person has something to say.
Yeah.
But I'm not really interested in some 20-year-old white kid from the suburbs. Like, what does that person know? You know, if you've lived your life a little bit, that's where a story comes from your life. I mean, you know, I worked with Michael Mann for a little, the director Michael Mann. I had signed on to write the book, the Heat book. And we, you know, Michael and I, it didn't work out. And I admire Michael, so this is nothing against Michael. We saw character in a very different way. Michael, to Michael, character is what someone does. And to me, character is what someone is.
Yeah.
And so we never, you know, we worked together for 2 years, and it was a really interesting experience. And eventually, Meg Gardner took over and did a great job and finished the book. And so no hard feelings. That bastard. No. But I just see characters grow from the inside out. And where do they grow? What inside? My inside. So, I think good writing comes from people who mind them, who aren't afraid to look in the mirror, and not just what's here, but what's in their, in Yiddish it's called their kishkes, what's in their guts. And, you know, people say, why do writers drink? And I say, well, if you saw our advances, you'd drink too. But drink, I think modern writers actually don't drink very much. To excess. I think writers of our parents' generation, you know, Hemingway and Fitzgerald and Faulkner and those guys, you know, men are allowed to cry now. Men are allowed to express emotion. Their generation, they couldn't. So that drinking was either for them to be able to access their emotions or to anesthetize themselves after they access their emotions. Not me. I mean, I don't have to drink to do it. I just drink a coffee and I can do it. And I would advise people, be conversational and don't be afraid to look in the mirror. Really look in the mirror. Because where you ask me where story comes from? Here.
The kishkas.
Right, the kishkas.
Love it.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. Where should viewers go to find your work?
I'm selling it on street corners. No, any bookstore will have my book. Most libraries have my books. And apparently AI has stolen most of my work.
Oh, lovely.
25 novels, like Anthropic. Yeah. 25 novels and about 10 of my short stories.
So will all AI stories going forward sound a little like you now?
Well, I don't know, but if you ask, you know, write a page like me.
Uh-huh.
They can do it.
Is it close?
You know, it lacks the kishkas.
Good.
That's what it lacks.
That's
but
what
you know,
we'll
eventually
have,
though, see, that's what the scary part is. Eventually, since it teaches itself, not in the way we understand teaching, but you know, large language files get smarter. And so eventually they'd probably do a good job of imitating me.
Do you think they'll ever replace human writers?
They better not. I'll kick its ass. No. I hope not. I hope not, because I think it's one thing to help doctors unravel the mysteries of proteins, which AI has done. Like, I'm not against AI. AI has its place, believe me. Cancer, if it ever gets cured, will be because of AI. And you'll be able to get drugs that aren't, you know, broad strokes. You'll be able to get drugs that are specific for you from now on. And that's great. My granddaughter will be able to live a healthier life than we all lived because of AI. But should AI replace human creativity? I think that's when you're getting into dangerous territory.
Well, no matter how much it can mimic, it'll never experience what humans do, right? It'll never feel the feelings of your Kishka.
Right. Well, God forbid it should stay out of my Kishkas.
I think we've talked far too much about your Kishka.
I think so.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, this was great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And I'd love to do it again.
Wonderful.
In 5 minutes.